Thank you very much for the invitation to speak. I'm going to tell you about a project which I carried out with my students, former students, Solomon Endlich and Junpu Wang, and the paper came out last year. I should mention that there's a much older paper by Gruzinov, which essentially studies the same system, inflation driven by a solid, and in a completely different language. And it's a very short paper, so it doesn't compute many things. But for those that he computes, we agree with the results. And it's a fairly unnoticed paper, even though I think it's a beautiful little paper. In fact, our paper doubled its citation record on Spires, so from 1 to 2. Okay, you should read it, because I think it's very nice, if you're interested in this subject. I should also mention that there's a much more recent paper by Chris Sigurdsson and collaborators, which came out a few weeks ago, which studies the same system. Okay, so before I tell you what I mean by inflation driven by a solid, which sounds like a pretty weird system, let me tell you our viewpoint. Okay, so I'm going to emphasize the effective field theory symmetry viewpoint. Okay. And so, in particular, there's this fairly recent formalism to deal with inflation, which is called the effective field theory of inflation, which is supposedly supposed to be very general, in fact, as general as possible. And the idea is the following, that since cosmology, and in particular, inflationary cosmology, is about homogeneous and isotropic universes, okay, we can parameterize the dynamics of perturbations by imposing these symmetries, okay, and imposing also the fact that these perturbations, at least some of them, should behave like Goldstone excitations associated with the presence of time-dependent background fields. Okay, so cosmology is about time dependence in some homogeneous and isotropic universe, and so this breaks formally time translations, and there should be some Goldstone excitation. Now, for those of you who are experts of Goldstones and, in particular, of spontaneous symmetry breaking in gauge theories, of course, in gravity, time translations are gauged, so the Goldstone is not really there, is eaten by the metric, like we say, via some sort of Higgs mechanism. But the Goldstone language is still a useful language, and it has some technical validity at short distances, much shorter than, in this case, the Hubble scale associated with the expansion of the universe. Anyway, so the Goldstone excitation associated with time translations is identified in this viewpoint with the adiabatic perturbations. Okay, and so as long as you're interested in just those perturbations, which are the only ones around, for instance, if you're studying single-field inflation, then the symmetries are so constraining to give you a very nice structure in the effective Lagrangian for these excitations, and like Kendrick was reviewing briefly yesterday, you can think of, for instance, CMB experiments as putting direct constraints on the coefficients in that Lagrangian, okay? And there is a systematic effective field theory that you can develop by these symmetry considerations. Now, this is supposed to be the most general thing you can have in inflation because of this starting point, no, that inflation is about time dependence in homogeneous and isotropic backgrounds. Now, I want to argue that there are other possibilities, okay? And in particular, here, I will tell you about a system in which I have matter fields that depend on spatial coordinates, not time, okay? So they are completely time independent, so time translations are unbroken in this case, and whereas spatial translations and rotations are broken by these x-dependent fields. And this apparently violates these two things that I just mentioned, the fact that cosmology has to do with an homogeneous and isotropic universe, and the fact that, in general, there is some time dependence, and in fact, you need that time dependence, for instance, to tell the universe when to end inflation, okay? So you need a clock, like we say, a physical clock. Now, here the matter fields do not play that role because they are time independent. As to the first apparent problem, this is easily fixed by imposing some internal symmetries on these fields, okay? I will tell you in a second what they are. And as to the second problem, as we will see later, gravity itself is playing the role of the clock in this system. Okay, so it's a completely different physical system than standard inflation, in which it's the matter field, it's the inflaton that plays the role of the clock. Okay, so let's see how to fix homogeneity and isotropy when you have x-dependent backgrounds. So let me start with a very simple example. Suppose you have a scalar field which acquires a vacuum expectation value proportional to x, the first coordinate, okay? So if the Lagrangian for the field has a shift symmetry under which phi shifts by a constant, then this background is not invariant under the original spatial translations, but it's invariant under a combined spatial translation and shift, okay? So there is still a residual symmetry which looks like translations, okay, in the sense that it has the same algebraic properties as translations, okay? Now, rotations are still broken here because x is a special, plays a special role, okay? Y and z do not appear here, only x does, and so rotations still differentiate between these three coordinates. So to fix rotations as well, you need three fields, one for x, one for y, and one for z. So how does it work? Well, it's very simple. So suppose you have three scalars, so now capital I is an internal index, which has nothing to do with space-time rotations, okay? It's an internal index in this field space. And suppose they acquire a VEV proportional to xi, so phi 1 is x, phi 2 is y, phi 3 is z, okay? Then if I have these internal symmetries acting on the fields, so shifts, constant shifts for each of them, and an internal SO3 rotation group that rotates them into each other, into one another, then there are unbroken diagonal combinations of internal transformations and space-time translations and rotations, which are preserved by these field configurations. And my pointer is dead. Is there another pointer? Thank you. Which one am I supposed to? Doesn't work. Yeah. Does it work? No?
Oh, you have to take that out. Yeah, there you go.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, so these diagonal subgroups are preserved by these field configurations, okay? So, meaning the following, in the presence of spatially dependent VEVs, you can still have residual symmetries that look like translations and rotations. And by look like, I mean they have the same algebra as translations and rotations. And so those can play the role of the unbroken, of the physical translations and rotations for your system in particular. The stress energy tensor can be invariant under this. The dynamics of perturbations can be invariant under this, okay? And the claim, which is somewhat weird, but I'll try to motivate it, is that this system is nothing but a solid, okay? Ordinary solid, like solid in the lab. So let's try to motivate that claim. So how do I parameterize the geometric deformations of a solid, okay? The mechanical deformations of a solid? Well, the configuration space of those deformations is given by specifying. So if this blob is your medium, solid or a fluid, but let's do the solid first, okay? It's the configuration space of the mechanical deformations of this medium is defined by giving for each volume element of this blob its physical positions x in your lab frame, let's say, as a function of some commoving positions phi. For the moment, I'm not talking about commoving coordinates of cosmology, okay? I'm talking about, let's forget about gravity for a second. This is a solid in the lab, okay? You can erect a system of coordinates that lives in the solid, gets deformed when the solid gets deformed, moves when the solid moves, okay? So those are commoving coordinates, and the configuration space of the solid is given by a mapping between physical coordinates and commoving coordinates, okay? This is pretty much like, let's say, the worksheet description of bosonic string theory in which you give target space coordinates as function of worksheet coordinates. Now here, it's more convenient, at least from my viewpoint, to use this mapping, to give the comoving coordinates as functions of the physical ones. Of course, at any given time, the mapping is invertible, okay, because it's the mapping between two three-dimensional spaces, comoving versus physical. So at any given time, you can use either description. I find this more convenient for the simple reason that now x and t just combine into x mu. So these are Poincaré coordinates, okay? And phi is just a scalar field. In fact, I have three scalar fields, because to describe a solid, I need three comoving coordinates for each volume element. So I have three scalar fields of x mu. And as I said, this is completely equivalent as giving a fixed t x as a function of phi, which would be the more mechanical, the more intuitive description from the mechanical viewpoint. But it's equivalent. And now, at this level, there's no real these comoving coordinates are not uniquely defined. So if I give you a solid in a random state, it's not obvious what are the preferred axes, okay? But there's a choice of coordinates which makes your life very easy, which is the set of coordinates that reduces to the physical ones, to the lab coordinates, when the solid is at rest in some homogeneous anisotropic state at for instance, thermodynamic equilibrium, okay? So it's a coordinate choice that aligns the comoving coordinates with the physical ones when the solid is at equilibrium at some, for instance, given external pressure, okay? So in this particular state, phi I is exactly xi, okay? And you see that we are recovering the fields that I was describing at the beginning of my talk, okay? And so, but as we said, this configuration breaks spontaneously because it's a state. It's not a breaking in the Lagrangian, it's a breaking in a state. This state breaks spontaneously spatial translations and rotations, okay? And so in order to describe a solid which is physically homogeneous and isotropic, you need to make up for this breaking by imposing the internal symmetries we talked about, okay? Now, there's an extra twist one can perform, which is the realizing that this is not the biggest symmetry group you could have for this media, okay? You could, in fact, have an infinite dimensional internal group, which corresponds to performing rearrangement of the volume elements that do not change the volume, okay, of any volume element. So rearrangement, so diffeomorphisms of the comoving coordinates that have unit Jacobian, okay? This, I claim, describes a fluid, okay? And it physically, this big symmetry corresponds to the fact that a fluid is insensitive to adiabatic displacements of volume elements. As long as you don't compress them or dilate them, the fluid does not respond, okay? The fluid only perceives compressional modes. Whereas for a solid, if you try to just displace volume elements around without even compressing them, but just displacing them, you feel strong transverse stresses that want those volume elements to go back to their rest position. Okay? So this big symmetry is associated with the physics of a fluid. Okay? And later, I will use this symmetry as well. But for the moment, I will just stick with this. Okay? And I should say that the fluid, this fluid description, we were not the first to figure it out, but we re-derived it independently, but it has a long history. And in fact, it was derived some time ago even by Brandon Carter and David Langlois, who should be in the audience somewhere. Yes. Okay, so for the moment, as I said, I will stick with the solid case and I'll come to the fluid later. So what's the action? Well, the action, according to effective field theory, to the effective field theory mantra, should be organized as a derivative expansion at low energies, and it should be given by the most general functional compatible with the symmetries, okay, of these fields, and once again organized as a series, as an expansion series in number of derivatives, okay? So at lowest order in derivatives, well, first of all, the shift symmetry tells us that each phi has to appear with one derivative, at least, okay? And then the Poincaré invariance tells us that all derivatives should be contracted, okay? So the basic object that I have to use to construct the action is this matrix, d mu phi I, d mu phi j. It has two free indices, I, j. These are internal indices. These are not special indices, okay? So these are internal indices. And in the internal space, I have this SO3 symmetry, okay, that I have to impose. Now, in three dimensions, with a symmetric matrix, I can only construct three independent invariants, which you can think of, for instance, the determinant, the trace, and something else, like, I don't know, the trace of the matrix square. Or you can say the trace of the matrix, the trace of the matrix square, and the trace of the matrix cube, and so on. But they are all, there's only three independent invariants, and then any other combination of these invariants you can express is also a SO3 invariant. Now, if I use this shorthand notation, which Claudia was also using yesterday, so the trace of a matrix I denote by square brackets, okay? So let me pick these invariants to be the following. The first one I call X is just the trace of the matrix, and the other two are the other traces, so the trace of B squared, the trace of B cubed, but I normalize them to X, to the appropriate power, so that X is the only one among my invariants which is sensitive to an overall rescaling of B, of the matrix. All the others are independent of the normalization of B, okay? And this will be a useful parametrization for what comes next, okay? So remember that X, Y, and Z are my SO3 invariants. They are not coordinates, so this is a very bad name. Unfortunately, it's now in the paper, so I cannot change it now. But these are not coordinates, these are my invariants. And X is the only one which is sensitive to rescalings of that matrix. Now, for the fluid, as we said, that big volume-preserving diff symmetry forces us to take the determinant as the only possible invariant, okay? Because the determinant of this matrix is the only invariant which is invariant under unit determinant Jacobian transformations. F is a generic function in both cases, and you can think of it as being determined by the equation of state, okay? So for a fluid, for instance, the equation of state is given by specifying the pressure as a function of density, okay? So if you give me that function, I can tell you what F is, okay? Because there's a differential equation for F relating energy and energy density and pressure. For a solid, of course, the equation of state of a solid is a more complicated object because it also depends on transverse deformations, but it still has the same, interpretation. It tells you how the solid responds to compressions, dilations, deformations, and so on. And so once again, if you give me the equation of state in physical terms, in terms of these responses, I can tell you what F is. So, but for us, it's a fairly generic function. Okay, so if you derive the stress-energy tensor, first of all, this was all in flat space, but now coupling to gravity is trivial. You have a metric here in this contraction, and then you have a square root of G in front. This is minimal coupling, and as usual, at lowest order in derivatives, this is the most general way to couple a physical system, a Poincaré invariant system, to gravity. So once you do that, you can derive the stress-energy tensor, and it has this schematic structure. So at the level of mu nu indices, you have two structures, either g mu nu or d mu phi I d nu phi j, okay? Because you have to derive those invariants with respect to the metric, and those invariants contain the contraction d mu phi I d mu phi j. And then there is an overall factor, which is either by f prime, I mean derivatives of f with respect to those invariants. And then these IAJ indices, since the T mu nu does not carry any, have to be contracted. And if you go through the algebra, they're contracting either with the delta or with B itself or B square, okay? So this is all you get. Now, the whole expression is fairly complicated, but once you specialize to the background, Bij equals delta Ij, because remember, on the background, phi I equals Xi, and now those Xi's are commoving coordinates, commoving in the sense of FRW now. And so Bij becomes a delta, and so this whole structure simplifies, and you get an homogeneous and isotropic stress-energy tensor, which you were guaranteed to get exactly because the whole construction was done to recover isotropy, okay, and homogeneity. And so in particular, as usual, you can parameterize it by rho and p. And in fact, it's more convenient to parameterize by rho and rho plus p, okay? Because rho and rho plus p, the ratio between the two tells you whether you are inflating or not, okay? So in particular, rho is just that function with a minus. And p, rho plus p, is the derivative of that function with respect to x, okay? Now remember that x was the only one among our invariants which is sensitive to dilations, okay? Dilations of b, meaning renormalization of b's. But Bij, remember, is d mu phi I, d nu phi j. So an overall rescaling of B is in fact associated, since phi I equals xi on the background, is associated with an overall rescaling, physical rescaling of the solid, meaning the mapping between the phis and the x get redefined by an overall constant when you rescale B by an overall constant. Okay? So this corresponds to actually stretching or compressing the fluid. And so it's natural that rho plus p, which is what enters in, for instance, the redshift of energy, rho dot equals minus 3h times rho plus p, is only sensitive to the sensitivity of the Lagrangian to x, because x is the only invariant that knows about changing the volume, okay? And so the way energy redshifts should know about changing the volume. Now, for inflation to happen, in particular for near exponential inflation to happen, we need some sort of slow roll condition. I put it in quotes because here nothing is rolling, okay? All my matter fields are time independent, exactly time independent. So nothing is rolling slowly or otherwise here. And, but you can still define slow roll parameters by the usual definitions in terms of H, okay? So like epsilon is minus H dot over h squared, and eta is epsilon dot over epsilon h, etc. Okay? And so you can define the slow roll parameter simply in terms of the geometry without ever referring to the potential of a slowly rolling field. Okay? And so in particular, to have small epsilon, so to have near exponential inflation with small h dot, you need this f sub x, this sensitivity of the Lagrangian to a rescaling of the solid, to be very small of order epsilon, not surprisingly, because if you want a solid, this solid, to drive exponential inflation, you want its energy not to dilute by a lot when you expand the solid by e to the 60, okay? And so the Lagrangian should be fairly independent of a rescaling of the solid. So it should have a small derivative with respect to the only invariant that depends on that rescaling. But this logic also suggests how to enforce this smallness by a symmetry, okay? It's an approximate internal scale invariance in which you rescale the comoving coordinates of the medium without touching the space-time coordinates, okay? And so, in a sense, this is a better behaved scale, form of scale invariance than the usual one. For instance, the usual form of scale invariance is generically anomalous because of non-trivial beta functions for, let's say, dimensionless couplings, whereas this is an internal scale invariance that is on the same footing as our, let's say, SO3 scale internal SO3 invariance. Okay, so we have an approximate symmetry that guarantees the presence of exponential inflation. Of course, now, at this level, we depart completely from standard solids in the lab, okay? So standard solids in the lab, if you try to stretch them by order one, not even order one, by order probably 1%, they break, okay? Here we claim that we have a solid which doesn't break if you stretch it by e to the 60, okay? Now, if you are uncomfortable by this assumption, forget about the word solid and think of this as a system of scalar fields with certain symmetries, okay? But they are the same, so you shouldn't be uncomfortable using the word solid. Okay, so now, of course, we are interested in excitations, okay? Otherwise, there's not much to observe. And the excitations of a solid are phonons. So in particular, in our description, they are just displacements from the background position phi I equals xi, okay? So let me call those excitations pi I. You have the Lagrangian for the solid, you expand it at quadratic order in perturbations. So if you neglect these interactions, this is the quadratic Lagrangian, and not surprisingly, you have transverse excitations and longitudinal excitations. In the fluid, of course, only these guys survive. There's no transverse propagation speed, but in a solid, you have independent propagation speeds for longitudinal and transverse, okay? Now, in fact, that it turns out that in the small epsilon limit, so for small slow roll parameters, the longitudinal and the transverse speed are not independent, okay? They're related by this formula here, which tells you that even when the longitudinal propagation speed, you choose it to be very small, Okay, the transverse propagation speed is always of the order of the speed of light. And it becomes the speed of light when CL squared goes to 1/3. Okay? Now, in particular, apart from some F sub x and F sub xx dependence here, but which is small because we are assuming that these guys are small, okay? Both these propagation speeds depend on this combination of derivatives with respect to the other invariants, okay? So that's why they're not independent, because they depend by the same combination, F sub y plus F sub z. And notice that at the denominator, we have something small of order epsilon. Remember that F sub x is of order epsilon. So in order for these guys to be subluminal, you need this object to also be small, okay, of order epsilon. You don't want the numerator to be much bigger than the denominator, okay? You want them to be at most of the same order. And on the other hand, I should mention, by the way, that we could not find, unlike for x sub x, we could not find a symmetry yet that guarantees that this is small, okay? So at this level, this is probably an arbitrary choice. We don't know whether it's a tuning in the technical sense, meaning we don't know whether it's destabilized by quantum corrections, but at this level, it's an arbitrary choice, not enforced by any symmetry. But if you make that choice, you still have the freedom to assume that F sub y and F sub z are generically larger than this, let's say of order F, which is unsuppressed. F is our energy density, okay? So, and only this particular combination is small, okay? Now, if you assume that, you have large interactions, okay? Because interactions here, the interaction terms, are going to depend, they're going to have as prefactors generic derivatives, okay, with respect to y, z, et cetera, and double derivatives and so on. And so if those are large, and only this particular combination is small, interactions can be large. So large interactions can be either exciting or a problem, okay? So let's first make sure that they're not a problem. When are they a problem? Well, they are a problem if quantum mechanically the system becomes strongly coupled at frequencies of order Hubble. Because to compute cosmological observables, like correlation functions, we need perturbation theory to be valid at frequencies of order Hubble, because that's the Friesshardt frequency, okay? So you want the strong interaction scale of the system to be much bigger than Hubble for the perturbation theory to be valid, okay? This is the theoretical need. Then, observationally, we already know that adiabatic perturbations are nearly Gaussian with very, very good approximations. So that means that that's an experimental evidence that interactions are weak at frequencies of order Hubble, okay? So we have to make sure that this is compatible with our system. And so, schematically, you have the quadratic Lagrangian, you can derive the interactions, and you can just check when interactions become strong. And they become strong at this scale, which I call lambda strong, which is something parametrically bigger than Hubble, because it's a geometric average between Hubble and M Planck, times an epsilon suppressed factor, okay? But, I mean, epsilon doesn't need to be extremely small, and so if this combination is comfortably larger than Hubble, this is perfectly consistent, meaning we can still have a very small epsilon and still have the strong Cambrian scale much bigger than Hubble, okay? Now, there's a minor modification when the longitudinal phonons are very non-relativistic, meaning they propagate much slower than light, then there is a correction to this formula that takes into account that, okay? But still, there's no inconsistency, meaning that the strong Cambrian scale can be very large compared to Hubble. Then, once you have that, so once you guarantee that that's the case, then from being a problem, large interactions become exciting, okay? Because it means that you're going to have large non-Gaussianities potentially. Yes? Like ordinary solids. Yeah, in a Minkowski background, you have a strong coupling scale, which is determined by here I'm taking the small epsilon limit, so it doesn't apply to ordinary solids. But let's say for ordinary solids, you have a strong coupling scale for phonons, which is determined by the density of the solid, the interparticle the interatomic separation, and so on. So it's still weakly coupled at energies parametrically smaller. Sorry, let's talk about momenta, because these are non-relativistic systems. At momenta, parametrically smaller, for instance, than the interparticle separation. Yes. Well, yes, because, yes, but that's, as I'm saying, ordinary solids in a Minkowski background do not correspond to this limit So here I'm explicitly taking the limit of small epsilon. So I'm neglecting many things that are suppressed by what I call epsilon. Okay, but in an ordinary solid, that epsilon is not small. Excuse me? In this model, yes, it doesn't have a smooth Minkowski limit. This is exactly the sub-horizon limit, no, in which lambda strong is so much bigger than Hubble that you can neglect the Hubble expansion. And so interactions become strongly coupled at this particular scale. Okay? Okay, and so as I said, when perturbations are weakly coupled, but still with potentially large interactions, then those interactions are interesting because they can give you large non-Gaussianities. And I'll tell you about that later. But let me first address the issue of the physical clock. Okay, so we need a clock to end inflation, to trigger heating, for instance. And here, so our action only depends by combinations of this Bij, okay? And there is a time dependence in Bij coming very prosaically, 10 minutes, thank you, very prosaically from this 1 over a square in the metric, okay? Whereas the metric fields, remember, they are, at least on the background, they are phi I equals xi, so there's no time there. Okay, so that's your time dependence. Now, any invariant that you construct out of Bij, for instance, the energy density, the pressure, all physical properties of the fluid, of the solid, are made out of Bij. And so any invariant will, like the energy density, for instance, will depend on time, okay? So in particular, in my parameterization of the invariants, I have two invariants, Y and Z, that do not depend on time because they are insensitive to overall rescalings of B. And 1 over A of T really appears here as a rescaling of B. So in my parameterization, X is the only invariant that depends on time. And so the time dependence comes from the metric. And so even though we have a clock, we cannot apply the standard, for instance, effective field theory of inflation construction because there is no real Goldstone excitation associated with this clock because the clock comes from the metric. And so in a sense, you get a time dependence when you move away from the so-called equivalence theorem limit in which you parameterize the short distance dynamics of spontaneously broken gauge symmetries via Goldstone bosons, okay? This is a comment for those of you who are who know what I'm talking about, okay? But if you have questions, I'm happy to elaborate on this. But so I guess what I'm saying is that this is a technical justification of why our system does not conform to the standard effective field theory of inflation, even though formally we have some time dependence in physical quantities, okay? No. Independence of gravity, no, because you have some density with gravity. Okay, and so this time dependence can trigger heating. So reheating for a solid, well, so here I'm really pushing the effective field theory logic, the effective field theory viewpoint to the limit, meaning I'm not going to give you, because I don't have it, I'm not going to give you any microphysical description of reheating, okay? I'm just going to parameterize the long, assuming reheating happens, I'm going to parameterize the long distance dynamics of reheating. And in terms of this media that we are talking about, reheating has to melt our solid, meaning it has to transform our solid into an ultra-relativistic fluid because the radiation dominance that we want, the radiation domination, dominated phase that we want after reheating is described by an ultra-relativistic fluid, okay? And so I'm assuming that there is a phase transition between solid and fluid at some critical value, for instance, of one of my invariants, determinant of B or trace of B or so on, okay? Now, the determinant of B is particularly convenient because remember, the fluid in our language is described by the same degrees of freedom as the solid, and that's why I don't need to give you any microphysical description because I already have the right degrees of freedom at long distances to talk about the fluid after inflation, but with different symmetries, and in particular, the action of the fluid is just a function of the determinant of B. So if I assume that reheating happens at some critical value of the determinant of B, I can have a very natural gluing of the solid phase into the fluid phase. Okay? So this is since our solid initially has zero temperature, okay, this is a melting of a solid at zero temperature. Now usually we melt solids by raising the temperature, Okay, but nothing tells you that you cannot melt them by, for instance, releasing pressure, which is what's happening during the exponential inflation of the solid. Okay, and in particular, for instance, we have a physical example, which is solid helium at zero temperature. You can turn it into liquid helium by releasing the pressure below 25 atmospheres. And if you go the other way, so from liquid helium to solid helium, if you raise the pressure above 25 atmospheres, you solidify, okay? Now, one difference is that we need our melting to be associated with the substantial release of latent heat, because we started with a zero temperature solid and we want to end up with a very hot fluid, okay? But we couldn't find any thermodynamic reason why that's not possible, to melt a zero temperature solid into a very hot fluid, okay? Another difference, of course, is that solid helium is 30% compressible at ordinary pressures, let's say, whereas we need E to the 60, okay, without breaking, but that's a different story. Okay, it's just a quantitative difference, in a sense, okay? Substantial quantitative difference. Okay, so as I said, this language is particularly well-behaved for describing this transition, because we already have the right degrees of freedom. We just have to change the symmetries of the Lagrangian at some critical value in some critical surface in field space. So in particular, let me give you just as an example. I'm not attaching any particular meaning to this example. Okay, it's just a mathematical example for a function doing that. So suppose your f that you want to describe is this function of the determinant of b times a generic function of y and z before reheating, and then this function of the determinant of B without any dependent on Y and Z after reheating. You just have to choose this little f so that it evaluates to 1 on the background, okay? And then this gives you a gluing between a solid phase with small epsilon and an ultra-relativistic phase, ultra-relativistic fluid phase with P equals 1/3 rho, okay? And of course, this gluing is sort of sharp, but you can make it as smooth as you want with the usual hyperbolic tangent tricks, okay? So, as I said, this is just a mathematical example. I don't have any physical justification for this. Now, the question is, well, there's a lot of technical details which I'm not sure I can go into. How much do I have? 5 minutes? 4, okay. So I don't want to talk about this, probably. But, these are technical details on how you compute correlation functions for perturbations, the action, etc. Okay, let me just give you the result, okay? So you go through the standard crank of the computation of correlation functions for cosmological perturbations, okay? And let's focus on scalar perturbations, okay? Scalar perturbations, which correspond to the longitudinal phonons here, are funny, okay? Funny means they violate Steven Weinberg's theorem of 2003 that states there should always be two adiabatic modes, and one of them has r equals zeta equals 0, and the other has r equals zeta equals constant, okay? So for us, there's no way to have r to be the same as zeta, okay? So they are different on super horizon scales. Neither is conserved, okay? And there are no adiabatic solutions, zero, meaning not that we also have isocurvature perturbations, meaning that there's not even a way to choose initial conditions in order to project onto adiabatic modes. And the physical reason is very, well, there's a technical reason. We see why we violate the theorem, okay, at the technical level. There's one technical assumption that Steven Weinberg makes, and he explicitly says this is the only technical assumption, and we violate exactly that assumption, okay? And at the physical level, it's pretty clear what's going on. So for a fluid, if you take a very long wavelength sound wave and you go to distances much shorter than the wavelength, if you now go to the local rest frame of the fluid, you only see a compression or a dilation. And so since the background evolution is already probing all levels of compression and dilation within some range, this perturbation is locally indistinguishable from the background evolution. And this is what we mean by adiabatic perturbations. For a solid, if you take a longitudinal phonon, which is the only scalar perturbation that you have, even in the infinitely long wavelength limit, you can still tell which direction the longitudinal phonon was propagating into, okay? Meaning there is some residual anisotropy there is an isotropic stress in the stress energy tensor, which is of the same order as, for instance, the perturbation in the pressure. So you can still tell apart an infinitely long perturbation from a background. Okay? Now, you should say that the time dependence that you get from this peculiarity is small, of order epsilon. Okay? Still, it's there, and these are not adiabatic modes, meaning they are locally distinguishable from the background, which raises worries about the model dependence of our conclusions, meaning, in particular, what happens at reheating could be relevant for the time evolution of perturbations, okay? Which is not the case for ordinary inflation. We checked that if reheating is much shorter, much faster than Hubble, this is not a problem, meaning we can still draw model-independent conclusions, but only under that approximation. In the much longer reheating phase case, we don't know actually whether our conclusions are model-independent. So let me just tell you the results. The results are the following. We have a tilt for scalar modes, which is different from the usual one. We have a tilt from tensor modes, which is much different from the usual one. In particular, it's positive, okay? So tensor modes are blue. This is a very sharp indication that this is a completely different system. Usually, you can have blue tensors only if you violate the null energy condition. Here, the tensors are blue simply because the usual splitting between tensors and scalars, and in particular between tensors and the time evolution of the background scalar, here is trickier because of the symmetry breaking pattern that we have. These are tensors under the residual rotations, which are not the original space-time rotations. And this creates some sort of mixing, okay? At the technical level, there is a mass term in the Lagrangian for the tensors that goes like the speed of sound of a transverse phonon squared. We have a three-point function with a funny shape. Okay, funny, so for those of you who know these plots, so these are the standard plots in the parametrization of Babich, Kreminelli, and Saldarriaga, okay? So this is the equilateral limit, and this is the squeezed limit. So you see our three-point function blows up in the squeezed limit, but in some sort of asymmetric way. It goes to plus infinity and minus infinity. So it's particularly clear if you look at it from the side. Sorry, let me just tell you something. So let's focus for 1 second. Keep in mind for 1 second this particular combination that appears in the tilt. Okay? We'll come later. And so if you look at the three-point function from the side, you see that it blows up to plus infinity and minus infinity depending on the angle at which you approach the squeezed limit that Kendrick was talking about yesterday. And in particular, it turns out to be a purely quadrupolar structure. Okay? And the overall normalization FNL is also unusual. It's huge, okay? It goes like 1 over that factor appearing in the tilt. Whereas usually, the consistency relation will tell you that the three-point function has to be proportional to the tilt and not inversely proportional, okay? And this shape has very, well, it has very small overlap with the other shape that blows up in the squeezed limit, which is the local shape. And it has sort of smallish overlaps with the other shapes that are on the market. And so it's a completely different shape, at least for models that have a single scalar excitation, okay? So I don't have time to go through the outlook, but let me just mention maybe this item here, okay? I think this is an interesting generalization. So far I talked about a completely isotropic solid, okay? Now, of course, in nature there's also crystalline solids which have preferred directions, okay? Now, we know that for cosmology, so far we have probed the isotropy of the universe at the level of the background and at the level of the spectrum of perturbations, okay? And so the question is, can we have a crystal which, by the way, to talk about the crystal, I should replace my SO3 with some discrete subgroup of SO3, okay? So can we have a crystal in which the background and the quadratic action for perturbations is accidentally isotropic, okay? But the three-point function is not. So this will give you something that is consistent with the data that we know so far, but a completely different three-point function with the preferred directions in the sky, okay? And in particular, it will not be constrained by present data analysis because those, of course, assume isotropy in the three-point function. Thank you very much.
So we have time for a couple questions for Alberto.
If you take, so you had the symmetry, phi I goes to lambda phi I.
Yes.
And if we'd make that an exact symmetry, then, I mean, you would have a simpler solution, which would be just the Sitter space, I guess.
Yeah, but it's strongly coupled. It's strongly coupled because remember that the sensitivity to, I mean, the breaking of that symmetry is what gives you epsilon. And epsilon, or f sub x, if you want, and epsilon appears in front of the quadratic Lagrangian of the phonons. So when that goes to zero, the quadratic Lagrangian goes to zero, which means that if you canonically normalize, interactions go to infinity. So that limit is infinitely strongly coupled.
Okay, thanks.
So just a quick question about the relation, the effective theory of inflation.
Yes?
You said that this captures a fluid, including, I guess, irrotational fluids. So in that limit, they're supposed to be the same thing?
Yes. Okay, very good. So that's, so do you want to elaborate or do you want?
I was hoping you could explain
yes.
what happened.
Okay, so that's a very particular limit in which, in which, as you're saying, there is an alternative description. So it's a singular point in a sense in which if you neglect transverse modes, which by the way is not obviously a good idea because they are very strongly coupled, so that's why we didn't do it this for a fluid. But if you neglect the transverse modes, you can go to a P of X description in which you just have a local Lagrangian for the longitudinal mode, and that, you know, conforms to the standard effective theory of inflation. So it's an isolated point, okay, in which you just have this duality, but you know that you have this duality only for that particular case. So, yes, it's an isolated point, but you cannot use this point to drive inflation. That's going to be strongly coupled. Not only for the transverse modes, but even for the longitudinal modes. We can talk about that later. But in a sense, you can show that you cannot keep the system, even the longitudinal guys, weakly coupled for many e-folds. The strong coupling scale is dropping exponentially with time.
So what's the gold? You said there's no Goldstone boson description. Here. So what becomes the Goldstone?
Well, in that case, the longitudinal phonon, in that particular case, can also be thought of as a Goldstone for time translation. But that's an isolated case. For a more general solid, that's not true. And it can, you know, it can precisely because of this duality, in which you go from an F of determinant of B description to a B of X description with broken time translations.
But you say it's isolated point. There's not some continuous region around that point
no.
where it looks like a Goldstone?
No. No, because that duality only works for that particular point.
I did some work a while ago with David Spergel where we were interested in sort of frustrated networks of domain walls.
Yes.
I think it was, we called it solid dark matter.
That's right. I forgot to mention that. Yeah, of course, we were inspired by your work. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, my question was, I mean, I just wanted to point out that, well, I guess in that paper, we had something similar where there were these three functions, but we also had this metric, basically, on, you know, three-dimensional metric on the solid or whatever, and I'm not quite sure. I mean, if I have like a piece of glass that I is cooled down, then it has stresses in it, and I was wondering whether your formalism sort of takes that into account.
Yes.
That it's not ice.
Yes, in a sense,
doesn't have an isotropic
state. Yes.
I don't know if my question is quite clear.
Well, I think it's clear. So I think the question is, this looks like completely different from the standard description of a solid in terms of, for instance, of shear and anisotropic stresses, in a sense. That's what your question is about. And it's equivalent. And in particular, you see, you essentially deconstruct these objects that you're talking about in terms of phonon fields, okay? So that when you go back, for instance, to the stress energy tensor that I wrote here. I didn't write all the contractions, et cetera, but the basic structure is this one, okay? When you go away from some isotropic background, so when you introduce perturbations, all this tensor structure here, in terms of B, where B now is some anisotropic matrix, when you introduce these Goldstones, these ghost excitations, is going to show up, is going to affect also, because of these contractions, is going to affect the mu nu structure of T mu nu. Okay? So now you will have anisotropic stresses, for instance. But those are parametrized in terms of our fundamental fields, which are the Goldstones. So in a sense, our pi i's are sort of building blocks for those composite objects that you're talking about, like a shear modulus, sorry, a shear deformation, the anisotropic stresses, etc. Okay. Does this answer your question?
I mean, why don't we talk about it later?
Okay.
I think so.
All right. We're going to take a short break and reconvene at 11:10. Let's thank Alberto one more time.
Thank you.